This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org.
All right. Good evening, everybody. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good. Good to hear your voice.
Excellent. You know, we've had some great episodes the last few weeks. I'm really glad that we kind of got them out there. The one on sexual abuse was very interesting. I've had a couple of emails thanking you for the great information that you gave us a couple of weeks ago. And then the procrastination one, a couple of people emailed me about procrastination, had some comments and listener questions. And then we did the procrastination episode. And I'll tell you, from my perspective, I've been procrastinating a little bit less, you know, and so it's been helpful in my life. Hopefully it's been helpful to some of our listeners. So we really appreciate that.
Excellent.
Yeah, this is great. You know, it's really great to see to hear evolutionary psychology and the theory of it. And it's just another level of, you know, greatness to hear it in terms of practical applications.
Sure.
Science is fine, but if you can't, you know, demonstrate it, if you can't do it, it remains in the shelves of a theory.
Yeah.
So, all right.
Today, what do we got?
Yeah, today we've got some listener questions, comments, and emails, and we're going to read we got a lot of emails in the last few weeks, and we're going to get to as many as we can. And we've got a few that we picked out, and if there's any callers that are listening and they really want their question answered, callers will take priority. So if you call in at 657-383-0751, then we'll go ahead and take your question, but we're going to start with the questions that we have right now. So again, the number is 657-383-0751. So let's see if anybody wants to write that down, but we'll just go ahead and get started. You ready, Dr. Lyle?
Cool. Let's do it.
All right. Okay. This question is for Dr. Lyle. You mentioned that the magic 10%, in other words, a true love pairing, occurs when each person in a relationship miscalibrates the other and rates them higher than they are objectively. So is the implication of this that in the remaining 90% of relationships, at least one person is actually not in love with their mate? If so, would this person be aware that they aren't in love and be faking it for the sake of appearances? Or would they honestly think that any happiness they feel is love, not realizing that it isn't? Also, for this 90%, would females have a greater likelihood of being the person not in love, since they are most likely sleeping down in the pair bond? In other words, is physical beauty the sole characteristic responsible for the true love feeling?
No. Yeah, there's it's the good questions here. There's some confusion about what I'm talking about. So they begin like they sound like they know what I'm talking about, then they wander into the weeds. So that's okay. This is good, because some of these concepts that I explain are very new to people, and so as a result, it's very easy for people to be a little bit mistranslation. So let me explain what the magic 10% is. So magic 10% is my name for the following phenomenon. Let's suppose that you are going to go, you're looking to buy a used Honda, and you go and you're expecting to pay $15,000 for a three-year-old Honda with 30,000 miles on it. So you go look at one, and lo and behold, there's one with 30,000 miles on it for $15,000. It's in about the shape that you're expecting. Now, I would say that you would be pretty interested and, you know, reasonably willing to make the deal. If it's the first one that you saw, you'd be interested, but you it would be marginal. And the reason is that you're not sure it's the best deal you could get. So then if you come upon another one and it turns out that it's a little bit better deal, it's $14,000, then you're more excited. So the amount of excitement you have for transaction has to do with your estimation of the relative value of that opportunity relative to other opportunities that you would expect to be able to have. So the same is true in the mating arena. So we can all see that people of, given that you're heterosexual, or it doesn't matter, we could be talking about homosexual folks as well, but given a certain calibration that you have for yourself in what it is that you could likely expect somebody to accept you as a mate, you are not particularly excited about somebody who is 10 or 20% less attractive. And by attractive, incidentally, I mean all things considered. I don't just mean physical characteristics. So it's going to turn out to be the case that when men look at women, a greater percentage of the female's biological value is observable visually. That is because men do not require, for their ability to reproduce, they do not require resources from females above and beyond their ability to be impregnated, particularly. Whereas for females looking at males, they actually are looking to not only get the male's DNA and reproduce the characteristics that they observe visually, but they're also looking to get resources out of the male in terms of his future efforts. So therefore, they have to look inside the male's personality and his intelligence, and they have to see, essentially, does this guy have good characteristics mentally that he's going to be able to procure resources, protect me, and be willing to share the resources that he gets. Those are far more complex decisions and require more data than just looking at the male physically. So we can see that by percentage, as the male observes the female, he can essentially estimate her mate value more accurately from a glance than a female can estimate the mate value of a male from a glance. And so, but we must consider all features of the organism when it comes to their mate value in total. That's actually going to include even things like who they know and what their family situation's like and what their financial situation's like and what their debt situation's like and a lot of other things. There's a lot that can feed into an individual's mate value, but mostly we can summarize it in three main issues, and that's what we're going to call looks, brains, and personality. And you assess those three things in that order. So you very quickly can get a percentile judgment on how where a person stacks up to the people that you would expect to be able to mate with physically. If they are better physically than most people that you would expect, that would find you acceptable, you're quite interested from the jump. Then we want to see how intelligent they are. If it turns out, they're quite attractive, but it turns out they're an idiot. Well, for the male, this isn't as big of a problem, but for the female, this is a very big problem. And so the guy's mate value will drop a greater amount than the same judgment that would take place on the part of a male finding out that a great-looking girl is an idiot. That's not. It doesn't cost her as many points, but it costs her something. All right. Finally, the personality issues as well. The personality issue of the male is going to be more important than the personality issue of the female for exactly the same reasons that I've outlined, because the male, we have to find out if he's hardworking and generous and that if he's even-tempered. So if he's fair, all these are characteristics that are critically important for the female to figure out whether or not she's going to get how many resources she can expect to get out of the situation, where the male does not have to care as much about these issues because the female is stuck with a pregnancy, and therefore if it looks like she's kept taking care of herself well enough and isn't a starving orphan with dirty hair, then it's going to turn out that she's probably tough enough to raise a child on her own or with a little bit of help, and therefore she's good enough personality-wise. So females will very often, incidentally, have this issue where if they see arrogance or selfishness on the part of a male, he can be often completely ruled out immediately behind the simplest issue of how he treats a waitress or a waiter. Whereas males will not rule out females that quickly for exactly the same reasons that we're talking about, that most of her mate value is observable through her physical characteristics. So, this being the case, all of these characteristics, looks, brains, and personality are all in the hopper. They are being assessed, and they are being assessed by the individual. You could essentially give people a mate value across these three dimensions. On each of those three dimensions, and we would do it independently, the person's mate value is some weighted average of those three characteristics. So let's suppose the person is a 10, 10, and a 9. So looks, brains, and then the personality is just a really good personality, but we've seen slightly better. They lie a little bit. They don't quite have the outstanding character that you've met a few times in your life. So they're a 10, 10, 9. Okay, so they're a very, very high percentile mate. Now, that sounds fantastic that we would all want that, but that wouldn't be true if you yourself were a 10, 10, 10. You would be considering that would be trading down. So what we do is we try to figure out, we calibrate ourselves relative to how interested other people seem to be to jump into relationships with us, and also how reticent people are to enter relationships with us. And we are running these essentially correlation coefficients on our mate value from this feedback. What's going to happen with all this is this is going to establish what we're going to call our calibration. And so the magic 10% is going to be when we feel that a person that is interested in us is a little bit fancier than us, maybe 10% fancier. So we actually feel like we're getting a deal. This is exactly the same excitement that we get when we feel like we've got a deal at Macy's on a sweater. It's or we get a deal on the used Honda. It's exactly the same process. It's the process of the genes working their way through assessment processes inside of our brain, essentially trying to figure out whether or not this is an excellent opportunity that we ought to aggressively pursue. It just so happens in this case, there's a tremendous amount of motivation and feeling and butterflies in our stomach and everything else. But the truth is, people can get the same kinds of feelings about some house that they're about to get to deal on and that they may get it at 10% cheaper. All right. I
feel the same way when I get
to
knees.
I've been weak in the knees over that situation too. So at any rate, what I call the magic 10% is when two parties in a romantic possibility both feel like the other one is a hell of a deal, that the other one represents the upper reaches of what it is that they could expect to get. The reason why I have, in a quasi-jaded way of describing this, is to say that effectively that each of them has miscalibrated the other is the following. That there is, for example, let's suppose you're a guy who yourself is an 8. So that means what you would dream of a 10, but you're probably not going to get that. That's outside of your reasonable range. But a 9 is not outside of your reasonable range. But there is some girl who thinks of herself as an 8 because that is the feedback that she's gotten from the world that she's an 8. But she happens to be your 9. Now, it's going to there's both subjectivity and objectivity in these ratings. So the objective rating for this girl is an 8. But subjectively, some people see her as a 7. Nobody sees her as a 6. Nobody sees her as a 10. But some people see her as a 9, a minority. So our guy who's an 8 sees her as a 9. She, our guy is an 8 himself. She, calibrated as an 8, happens to see him as a 9. So as a result, these two people who carry for each other a slightly distorted relative to the objective market, they have a slightly distorted view of each other's value. Both of them now feel like they've got a hell of a deal. That's what true love is. That's what ignites that. It is the excitement of feeling like you are getting a great deal. You do not get excited over feel like you're getting a deal that you completely deserve and have coming to you. That doesn't happen. Okay? There has to be the bargain attitude that comes with this. And you will find that people that have had the beginnings or particularly longer lasting, exceptionally good love relationships will say that, quote, they feel lucky. Okay? They feel like they were very lucky. That's the sign of an individual who's saying, I feel like I was over rewarded. Okay? Maybe not hugely, but enough. Not enough to feel insecure, like it was absurd and giddy. Just enough to feel like this is a hell of a deal and I'm taking it. Now, so the magic 10% has nothing to do with the percentage of relationships that exist here. So our person was a little confused about the other 90% of relationships. No. I don't think that a lot of relationships, it's probably not likely that 10% of existing, for example, long-term relationships have people that feel like they're living the magic 10%. So maybe they are, but I don't think so. That's not been my experience as a psychologist. So most people will feel the magic 10% for a period of time, usually early in a relationship, until they find out all the baggage and dirty laundry, you know, comes to light in the first year. And at the end of the first year, that Honda that had 30,000 miles on it for $15,000, that the guy discounted down 10% to 13.5, and you were all excited and you were, quote, in love with the car. Well, when you found out that actually, you know, there's a problem with the transmission, the love that you feel for the car goes through somewhat of a transformation. And so it's going to turn out that an awful lot of existing relationships that people are in begin with the euphoria of the magic 10% and then settle down into a, quote, trade that feels reasonable but does not feel like it's a great trade. So this is I have no idea what percentage of relationships where people feel like they are really fortunate and are in love with their partners. It's some, you know, ironically, it probably is 10%. The research evidence would say that it's probably in that range, 10 or 15% or so of long-term relationships look to be very happy, and then a whole lot of them are real so-so, kind of what you'd expect after you find out that the magic 10% really wasn't there. So that's a long answer to a question that had a lot of little nuances to it, but I hope that covers it.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, next question.
All right. Go to another one.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Okay, Dr. Lyle, is there a scientific explanation for men with characteristics typically observed in women, like the speech patterns, emotional sensitivity, interest in color and aesthetics, music preferences, body language, etc.?
Yes, of course there is.
Tell us about the Marlboro man that you knew, by the way.
Oh, you remember that story. Yeah, years ago, God, we won't talk about how long ago this was, but it was a long time ago. It was before, it might have been before the three-point shot in basketball. So anyway, this is a long time ago, but I was an intern at a counseling center at the University of Virginia. And there was a guy that had been one of the models for the Marlboro Man. He was made good money as a young man. He had these screaming great, you know, square jaw, et cetera. And his name was Larry, by the way. And it turns out that Larry, he wasn't gay, but I mean, we all thought he was. He was very effeminate, very artsy, et cetera. And so the ironic thing was he looked like the Marlboro Man, but he looked like he belonged in the movie Birdcage. That's how he actually behaved. So yes, it's going to turn out that these characteristics are definitely, you know, biological. It looks to be obviously largely genetic. It could be that there's other factors in utero that are taking place. These characteristics are being set up very early in early brain development, and so that's what you're looking at. It's overwhelmingly dictated by genetic variances. And you're just talking about hormones causing the neural tissue to be more androgenized or more estrogenized. And so the way this works is that men have an awful lot more androgens than women. probably 10 to 1, I think, or more or less in that level. I think the circulating differences between an adult man and a woman in testosterone is, I think, about 7 to 1, maybe more than that. And then with women, obviously, it's estrogen is going to be the main sex hormone. So essentially all women have more estrogen than any man, and essentially all men have more testosterone than any woman. Now, this isn't to say I haven't met some women who could beat me at arm wrestling. No, I have. So, and they didn't tend to have real pretty feminine faces. All right, so the you can see evidence of the amount of testosterone and estrogens in people just by looking. So in my case of my my friend Larry, they're back at the University of Virginia, it was sort of the striking contrast where the body, the genes that built the body said one thing, and the genes that built the mind got a very completely different set of genes with respect to their sex hormones. So yes, men are effeminate men because they were born that way, and this has to do with genetic variances that their mothers or their fathers potentially essentially had genes for high estrogen, and that's what you got.
So their mom didn't raise them and like teach them how to be more feminine.
No, or anything like that. I love it. This is the one place where I could just relax and tell the truth without worrying that I'm offending somebody in the audience. Because if I am offending some social worker or psychologist out there, at least I don't have to see it and see that they're upset and exasperated listening to me and ready to object. No, your personality is genetic. It undergoes essentially zero systematic alteration from environmental events. So for people that are upset and they've gone to the university and they heard that it was 50-50, my friends, it's not even remotely close to 50-50. There is of all the environmental events that they have tracked and trying to see if there's an environmental pattern, i.e. a dominating mother, a permissive father, I grew up, you know, the fourth boy after three sisters, or the third sister after four boys, or I grew up with five brothers, that's why I'm more testosteronized as a female. This is all nonsense. It's got absolutely nothing to do with it. Your personality is almost entirely dictated by the genetic code, or what happens. The reason why two identical twins aren't literally identical is because of essentially random events that are taking place mostly in utero, causing a lot of slight differentiation of neural tissue. And then also, of course, your entire life history alters you in completely unpredictable ways, not in ways that can be predicted by any theory with any kind of psychodynamic concept. So if your mother is more permissive, it doesn't make you a flake. Neither does it make you more organized because you were so upset because your mother was such a permissive flake herself that you had to, like, get it together and be organized. That is not how you arrive at your personality. You arrive at your personality through the same way that you arrive at your facial structure and the color of your eyes and the color of your hair. You arrive at that by your the genetic variance that was handed to you. So that is why that works.
Now, a little side question.
Yes.
Is the equivalent in personality, let me set this up a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's say, like, physically, someone lets themselves go, they don't exercise, they don't eat whole natural foods, they eat really rich foods, and they look very unappealing after a certain amount of time. What is the equivalent in personality? Is this someone who just, like, stays up, holds themselves up into the video games and never learns how to, you know, conquer social skills, or?
I would say that you've got a point there in the sense that in the same and for the same reasons. The reasons why people get in trouble physically is because we've removed themselves from the natural environment. So in the natural environment, people had to eat whole natural foods. They had to exercise vigorously. They had to get bed on time, and they didn't do any drugs. And so as a result, they were, you know, aside from the hookworms that they sometimes had to deal with and the diseases that they might wind up getting, the truth is that they were otherwise in screaming shape. I had a friend of mine that went to Machu Picchu, which is, you know, one of the meccas of the of the educated people of the world that you have to go there someday. So in theory, I have to go there someday, but I'm really not looking forward to it. So anyway, the point is that you hike up, they hike up, I don't know, to 14,000 feet through some pass, and they have these Sherpas, these guys that, you know, are hauling all their equipment up. And my friend, somebody that you and I both know, Nate, a hell of a, mm-hmm. a hell of a doctor and a hell of a physical specimen. The mm-hmm. guy was a serious track runner. This guy basically had to work extremely hard to get himself just up the mountain. He couldn't carry anything. Sherpas carried everything. He says, when we got to the top of the mountain, all of us are gasping, and all of us are pretty athletic people, or we wouldn't even been on that trip. The Sherpas, meanwhile, put down these 80-pound packs and drop a soccer ball and start to play. All right. So the point is that these guys are a lot closer to the Stone Age environment, and obviously they're adapted to the altitude. But the issue is here that, yes, people can, as a result of modern circumstances, they can make less of their physical being than it should be. Behind essentially energy conservation programming or laziness allows this to happen. And energy conservation programming leads them to eat very, very rich foods consistently and then get out of shape and then lose their sex appeal. In the same way, the circumstances can conspire in an individual's life to make it so that they do not have to make very much of themselves. And the same kind of energy conservation programming as well as a multitude of other factors can drive them to not actualize as much of their potential as they would have had to actualize in the Stone Age just to participate in the village in normal commercial transactions for food and protection. And as a result, they can be, by not actualizing their capabilities reasonably, they can be handicapping themselves in normal human relationship advertisements. So that can hurt them as well. So that would be equivalent. So I wouldn't go so far as to say it's, quote, personality, because the personality isn't changing. But the circumstances are conspiring to make the person make less of their native abilities than they would otherwise have done.
So they can no longer appropriately display their personality characteristics in a,
that's correct,
a productive fashion.
Right.
Or at least, they're not.
Yes.
Okay.
Sense. That'd be the right way to put it. Excellent.
Okay. All right. Well, we have a caller here. We have a caller here. So let's see what we have here. All right,
sure.
Caller, you're on with Dr. Lyle and Nate here. What's your name?
Hey, Nate and Doug. This is Rob calling from Hawaii.
Cool.
Hey, Rob.
Hey,
what's
Doug.
Welcome.
Thank you. Doug, that video that Chef AJ put up a few days ago, Weight Loss Wisdom with Doug Lyle,
yeah.
You're sitting there with your legs spread open. I don't know if you know, Doug, that's called man-spreading.
Oh,
and,
my God.
Not only were you man-spreading, but you then went on to man-splain thing. You meant man-explain things. So.
All right. Very good. Thank you.
I just wanted to ask you, Doug, real quick. I'm not vegan, but I obviously was influenced by you and many people to, you know, eat a healthier diet and stuff. But I was surprised by what you said on a couple of shows ago about veganism. I think a lot of people perceive you as one of, like, the quote-unquote famous vegans.
Mm-hmm.
So do you still believe in, like your continuum of evil and, like, the A to D, A to F rating and, you know, eating – like what you said to John Mackey in that interview, he was asking about salmon, and you were like, "Oh yeah, if you eat that, you're gonna increase your chance of major tragedy." Do you still believe in all that stuff?
Yeah, this is. We'll just take a little sidewinder. That's good questions here. The some people do know me from the vegetarian and vegan world, and in that world, there's legitimate concern and some questions, and people can wander off and get a little bit doctrinaire about their position when it comes to what's the healthiest way of eating and so on and so forth. I don't have a strong position about this. I would say that, so just to take this question a little bit, I would say that the evidence suggests by the studies done by Dean Ornish and Caldwell Esselstyn that it's clear that if you have serious pathology in the cardiac arena, which is the number one cause of death and disability in the United States, that that a vegan or near-vegan diet has been the only mechanism shown to reverse that pathology. Now, it does not follow that that means that you have to eat a vegan diet in order to prevent that pathology. It just indicates that the vegan diet is extraordinarily clean with respect to that problem, whereas nobody's been able to show, well, Dean Ornish's research isn't pure vegan. It was 97% vegan. So he had 3% of their calories came from low-fat yogurt, pretty close to a pure vegan diet. So nobody has had a diet that the paleo people would like the looks of that has been able to show the reversal of atherogenesis. So the so I believe that when we look at different kinds of foods, we can look at the evidence from multitudes of studies, and we can sort of line up how problematic different foods are and put it on a continuum. So I put whole natural vegetable food in the A range. As we start to process the food, I move it down the chain. As we move into animal food, if we have fried animal food, for example, with the heated oils, become rancid and wind up causing the development of free radical formation, as well as the problematic issues of animal food, you wind up with what I call an F, the worst food that you can eat. Now, in between those ranges, there's plenty of room for debate. And so I could not tell you, and I don't know that I believe, that if you had a diet that was 10 or 20% of calories from animal food where the animals were very healthy in Stone Age terms, and you had 80% of your calories, for example, from whole natural plant food, I believe that that would be a very healthy diet. Whether or not that would be a better diet or how close that diet would be to a modern, very healthy vegan diet, I don't know if it would be superior, inferior, or very close. My gut tells me, looking at the evidence, that it would be close. And I don't think it would be quite as good, but I think it would be close. So I use a lecture called The Continuum of Evil, which is, I believe, on my website for free. This is essentially the story of grading food along a continuum rather than what happens to people when they start to learn about dietary issues is they get very emotional about the concept of whether something is right, wrong, black, white, legal, illegal, you know, a sinner or a saintly behavior. They divide the world into right and wrong, and they have a problem seeing things on a continuum. And yet reality is almost always on a continuum, and it is not on a categorical right and wrong. And we believe we probably know why human beings do this. They probably do this because you could not communicate with each other without the use of words which define discrete categories. So we talk about red, yellow, blue, et cetera. We don't start talking about microns of the difference of the wavelength of light. That's not how we're built. We use a word to describe a category. And so as such, we tend to think in categories because of the way the brain was designed for that problem. And as a result, people start thinking in terms of good, bad, in terms of food, instead of on a continuum. So I want people, the continuum of evil was specifically directed at that problem, and it was trying to get people to say, look, just do better than you're doing, know how to score the food, and I believe animal food is on the lower end of the continuum. There's some disagreement. It depends upon how healthy the animal is. It depends on how you prepare it. And I believe that whole natural vegetable food, unprocessed vegetable material, is outstanding for people. And I say that not out of opinion, but I can, again, look at the number one killer in the United States and look at the only studies that have shown to be able to reverse that process even deep into people's troubles on the death door is a vegan diet. No oil, you know, devoid of sugar, fat, salt, et cetera. Added sugar, fat, and salt. These kinds of diets, very pristine, have a stunning track record, and that's why they belong in the A range. So, good question, and thanks for asking. And I I haven't watched that thing from AJ. I'm not sure I want to watch it, but thank you. Thanks, Rob.
Rob, thank you very much for the call. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, good.
All right.
Let's go on.
Okay. And, you know, also, you know, to your point of us, you know, using language to talk about certain categories,
yes.
It seems like people are starting to use language that indicates that things are on a continuum. Like, hey, I saw that color. It was like red-ish, you know, I'm vegan-ish, you know,
uh-huh.
And that there's a lot of ambiguity in there so that people say like, hey, don't put me into any boxes here.
Yeah, I'm sort of committed-ish to the relationship. Yeah. All right. Let's see what else we got.
Speaking of relationships, we've got a question about a relationship.
Okay.
Okay. This girl wrote to us. Excuse me. Okay, Dr. Lyle, I have an unusual question for you. I'm in my mid-20s, and I've been on and off with my ex-boyfriend for the past 5 years. He was my first love and my first real relationship. And I was devastated when it ended approximately 1.5 years into our relationship. And although it ended at the time, we always found ourselves coming back to each other. Both him and I dated other people in this time, but we both have never felt the same connection that we felt for each other. Because we've been on and off so many times, I don't have well wishes from my family and friends for continuing this relationship. And as a result, I don't share this part of my life with them anymore. Mm-hmm. On to my sex life. My sex life with him is very spontaneous, exciting, and passionate. I've never had such passionate sex with anyone else. He has discussed the idea of marriage with me. However, it's based on the agreement that we have a polyamorous relationship where we keep things exciting by having threesomes. We recently tried this together, and I didn't feel jealousy, but I found the experience exciting, and he was very considerate of my feelings and my overall experience. His argument is that this will keep our relationship passionate moving forward, as I have fears of being cheated on, not necessarily by him, but in general. He says we would only have threesomes if we are open and honest with each other and have sex with others outside our relationship together only. With that said, I don't know what to do. While I did enjoy the experience, I'm still hesitant for the future. Not only have we had a rocky past, I don't know if I will have my family's approval if we decide to remain together. But I also don't know what effect having threesomes will have if we decide to get married, have a family together, and what the effect would be if we introduce others into our relationship strictly on a sexual basis.
You know, this would have been so much more exciting if it was a female reading this to me. All right.
I don't think I have the genetics to read it like that. I can say with a list, but that's about it.
Yeah. All right. Let's look at this. The good question. And obviously, young person, how old was she?
She's in her mid-20s.
Mid-20s. Okay. I'm hearing some outlines of some dynamics here. Number one, I'm hearing that there's an openness to experience on both of these people's parts. So these are not conventional people. They are somewhat unconventional people. I'm also hearing, from what I can hear, is how she was devastated when this relationship ended after a year and a half. Yet that suggests to me that he dumped her. So we haven't heard about what the threesomes are, but it sniffs to me like it's a third female. A second female as opposed to a second male in this thing. So I don't know if that's true. But if this were true, this would suggest that he is essentially, and her talking about how great this sex is for her, it's wonderful and fantastic, et cetera. This has the magic 10%. Stamped all over it from her perspective. So the fact that she is open and willing to follow, to potentially follow him down a road of this kind of experimentation suggests to me that she may feel over-rewarded in the relationship and is aware of this, but is trying to essentially give rope here and see whether or not the relationship can survive it. Now, what to do about this? The Several things. First of all, I can completely understand keeping it from your family because your family watched the girl go through all this devastation. And obviously, if they knew what the real dynamics were happening, if they're not the wide open hippies, they don't have too many hippie chips in there, they're not going to like the sound of anything like this. Now, my take on this looks like as follows. I wouldn't be worried about I wouldn't worry too much about family approval, so I would continue on in doing whatever it is that you want to do and keep your family at a distance as far as this issue is concerned. I have essentially two problems with young people, and I tell parents, you know, they've got some young kid flunking out of school or whatever it is. I say, look, you've only got two problems, or they've got a bad attitude. There's only two problems with young people, drugs and pregnancy. Everything else you can fix. Drug addiction is a monster. And if it turns out that you wind up an addict, that could be a devastating battle for the rest of your life. You have some kid get pregnant at 17, 18, 19, that can be a life-changing event that if they don't feel like terminating that pregnancy, this could wind up, I'm not saying devastating their life at all. It could be a fantastic thing. They could have great joy in having a child. But the point of the matter is it alters the trajectory of their options. And this is why it is that we don't want to see it. Okay. So I would say the same thing to this young woman, that the openness should end at drugs. The openness, we also don't want to wind up with some nasty disease, obviously, so you want to play very safe. And you sure as hell don't want to get pregnant in the context of a relationship that is inherently unstable. It's two young people finding their way. And I would add a third thing along the line of drugs and pregnancy to this, and that would be marriage. Okay. Now,
this is right before Thanksgiving. I'm going to have some great discussions tomorrow.
The reason why I say this is because in this situation, we are a hell of a long way from getting married. It doesn't matter what the family says. This culture, you know, as we talked about this before, the entire evolution of marriage, cultural evolution of marriage, all came about from essentially trying to protect the DNA's interest as we came to have wealth. And so we're not going to go back through this today. But what I would also say is that the world is now in the process of a phenomenal metamorphosis where we are able to start to separate that back out to some degree. So that in the old, old days, i.e. before 1960, a pregnant young woman out of wedlock was a tragic set of circumstances because of the financial implications. Most people have no idea what was happening economically in the United States. People that are living today don't remember. It turns out as late as the late 1960s, something like half of the labor force was making minimum wage. That's unbelievable. It's nothing like that today. Minimum wage is the arena of young people working at Starbucks. This was not the average wage earner that came home and tried to raise children. Okay, that is not what is going on today. Those people, the backbone of America, do not make minimum wage today. They did. So you can imagine how devastating it would be to try to be a single mother in 1957 staring at minimum wage and single motherhood. Unbelievable problem. So that's why marriage was pounded into everybody's skull. But that's what you better do before you start having sex, because then you're going to have pregnancy, and then you're going to be economically devastated unless you've got two people facing this problem instead of one. Okay? Now, so what we don't need to do is we don't need to have marriage in this mess. So I would tell this young woman, I have no issue with the openness to experience that you have, the fact that you are your guy has a curiosity about sexuality that he feels like he would like to essentially not get caught in a situation where he is exclusive, and that he wants to tickle what I call the chip that says wife, 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 chippy, which is what we can see resides in most males of the species. And we can tell by the log linear plots that we do of testicle size against body size in all the primates, and we can see that the human male on average comes from a long line of male ancestors that had more than one mating partner at any given time in their life. So they were mating a primary female and then getting a little action on the side. Now, how could this be true? Because it turns out that you, folks, if you're alive today, you come from a long line of the winners. You come from a line of the males that got more than their share of the female DNA. And so they did this not by being stand-up little guys who had one sexual partner. They were stand-up guys that worked hard and provided assets for females and fell in love with them, but they also tried to get some action on the side and did, okay? So our little gal here in this circumstances has a guy that says, you know what, I'd kind of like to have it wife, 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 chippy. That's exactly what he's saying. And she's saying, boy, it feels a little scary, okay, which it should. It should feel a little scary because and she probably feels a little scared to say no because she's probably a little bit feels over-rewarded. So the dynamics here are, I would say, not that stable. And so my attitude is, if you're 25-ish years old, no rush. You don't get pregnant, don't do drugs, don't get married. You will discover in the next 2, 3, 4 years whether or not you are married. You don't get married, you find out if you are. And you'll find out if you are, if it turns out that the way this unravels or the way this sort of comes to pass, that it winds up being stable, winds up being unthreatening, winds up being a little novelty that the two of you can share and handle, and the rest of the world would look down on and say that's too wild. But you know what? It doesn't matter if it works for you, it works for you. So, but don't try to determine in advance whether it works for you. You have to discover whether it does. If it turns out that jealousies and instability and problems result, then you have things to talk about. And then we can discuss and figure out where we are from there. So right now, it sounds like life is good. Life feels good, life feels exciting, and the experiment that you had did not blow up in your face. So that just like anything in life, if it worked and it seemed to work, there's no reason not to try it again. But understand that we're not even thinking about marriage and children right now, because this relationship is way not a marriage. It's not close, okay? We will discover in the next few years whether it is. If it is, then it's easy. And if it's not, then we haven't locked ourselves in with expectations from the social environment and a church and the government and everything else under the sun. That essentially puts up a barrier to exit to a relationship that keeps a lot of people locked into things that they wish they hadn't been in.
Fantastic.
All right.
Great. All right. We got two more questions. So let's see if you know, we'll answer one, and then if you have time to get the last one in, then we'll go from there.
Okay. Sure.
This is now from the other side. I am a 55-year-old healthy male. How does evolutionary psychology affect me in the dating market?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question. I'm not sure what he's asking. How does it affect him in the dating market? How does evolutionary psychology? Well, evolutionary psychology doesn't affect you in the dating market. Evolutionary psychology is simply psychology. We just call it evolutionary psychology because everybody that doesn't understand evolutionary psychology that's in the field has an incorrect theory of human nature. So evolutionary psychology, we should just drop that first term, but we signal who we are by using it, i.e.
we should call it
in the know.
They should call it revolutionary psychology. That's, yeah. I think so.
Yeah. So how does it affect you? Well, the real question is, you know, what are your how could it benefit you to know evolutionary psychology? Would be a good question. And it could benefit you in a number of ways that we've talked about in this program before. So it's useful to know, looking inside yourself, what is it that you're trying to accomplish with respect to any given female? What do you want most? What is the end that we seek? Do we seek casual mating partners? Do we seek something in between to not fall into our own categorical paradigm here? The relationships are on a continuum. And on one end of the continuum, it is the ultimate of casual mating strategy, which is going to be what we call the He-Man strategy, which is where women are throwing hotel keys at Elvis or Mick, you know what I mean, et cetera. That, i.e., no paternal investment is even remotely signaled by the female for the male to be acceptable. On the other end of the continuum is the female who is demanding the moon just to give her a kiss on the cheek, i.e., you are outclassed and there's no way you're going to get to these eggs. So this is the continuum. And so what we have to do is, if you're a 55-year-old guy, the first question we ask is, what is it that you want most? Do you want a parabon relationship where you feel the romantic love process as fully as you can? Or are you more interested in casual mating? And the reason why we ask that question and try to face it squarely is that in order to make the most of our lives, it helps to know which of our values is the one that is the most important. Your values are all inherently in conflict with each other. You can't both eat steak, you know what I'm saying, and be a vegan. You can't do that. You've got to do one or the other. You can't have a banana shake and then have an orange shake as well. You can't buy the red Honda and then also buy the black BMW. You have a limited, well, you could if you're rich enough, but you can't drive them both at the same time. So inherently, everything that you seek comes at the expense of an alternative option. And so it's useful to understand that in your brain, as a male, you have two very different mating strategies. And to understand clearly that when you meet somebody, if you're iffy about her, that means that all she qualifies for is casual mating strategy. And so we have to be clear with ourselves, if that's really not what we want, then you are wasting time in your pursuit of a parabon strategy. And on this program, I'm not particularly interested in trying to delineate the optimal techniques for males to pursue casual mating strategy. You know, there's the pickup artist website, and there's all kinds of ways to try to go about that process, usually in a feeble manner. What I'm interested in is the most exquisite experiences of human life, which are romantic relationships, and those relationships require that we meet people for whom we feel like we are at the upper limits of what it is that we could reasonably trade for, the magic 10%. And so evolutionary psychology will tell us what is on the other side of the table. And as a man, we should know that it is reasonably likely to be the case that if we are very interested in a female from the jump, it is exceedingly likely that they are not very interested in us from the jump. And it is also very likely to be the case that they think that they are seeking a situation where they are extremely interested in us from the jump, and they're going to rule us out if they do not feel that from the jump. And so females, not knowing their own psychology very well, have very often been the target of the casual mating strategy of men that are their genetic superiors. And so they have felt weak in the knees and giddy, and they feel like that's what true love is. That's when they've had some very exciting sex that then turned into a broken heart 6 weeks or 6 days later or 6 hours later. And so it's going to turn out that if you're a male listening to this program, what we will try to do from time to time is explain the optimal strategies for you as you go about the process of trying to find a female who has the magic 10% within here for you, and knowing full well that you are very unlikely to qualify at that level very quickly, and your job then is to sell your inner beauty, and you don't have a lot of time. So she's got a list full of prospects that are equal or superior to you in terms of her initial screening, people wealthier, taller, smaller, muscular, younger, handsomer, whatever. Okay? There are people that are your superior who are looking to pick her off as a casual mating strategy target and will float the idea that they could be seriously interested with her in order to get into her pants. That is a routine situation on the part of the female that you would be interested in. That will not be true if you are a 10-10-10 and you have no superiors, but if you are a 10-10-10, you aren't single. All right? So as a result, what we're doing here is we try to get inside the female mind. We try to figure out how it is that she works, how it is that she makes her decisions, and most importantly, where she makes her mistakes. And so we're going to try to step her around those errors as we give her every opportunity to see our inner beauty and our worthiness as a pair bond partner so that she can join with us in life's most exquisite adventure.
Wonderful. I think we will end there and we will save the rest of the questions for our, give us a few more episodes and then we'll do this again with any more listener questions, comments, and emails.
Excellent.
Dr. Lyle, thank you very much again. Right before the holiday, we'll have plenty of stuff to talk about with family members, friends, and anybody we want to argue with.
Yeah, sure.
Or actually,
that's
no.
Good.
As you've said, we shouldn't really be arguing. Not where happiness comes from.
Don't bother.
All right. Thanks very much, Dr. Lyle. Have a good Thanksgiving, and we'll look forward to talking with you next week.
Fantastic. See you soon, Nate.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.